And you got Whitley coming up afterwards?
Yes, sir. That's the plan, at least.
Tell him hi for me.
I will. Want to welcome everybody to this evening's Maryland Report. Before we begin, I got to remind everybody that those opinions of the host and guest, plural tonight, are those of the host and guest and do not represent any sponsors, affiliates, or anybody else. My first guest tonight, I'm excited to have him back on, is George Norrie from Coast to Coast AM, best-selling author. I don't want to get too far into the bio. If they don't know who you are by now, they probably are never going to know how you're doing. How are you doing tonight, George?
Jimmy, I'm great. Looking forward to being on your program, The Mallard Report. I've heard so many good things about it. You finally corralled me and got me on.
Yeah, you're like nailing Jella to the wall, but I keep after it, and that's what you tell me to do, and that's what I tell people to do about coming on my show. You got to keep after me. And finally, the squeaky wheel gets the oil.
I'm looking forward to it. Let's go for it.
So I wanted to ask you a couple media questions, because we've talked about paranormal and radio in the past, but there's some things in the media right now, or radio more specifically, that have caught my eye. I want your opinion on them.
Okay.
Like Michael Savage going to podcasting. Now, how do you feel about that? Because is that a blow to you, or is that a good sign that radio is still the thing?
Well, you know, we podcast Coast to Coast as well. We edit it down and make a condensed version of the show. It's just another source. It's another way for people to be able to listen to programs they like. And, you know, we're on 680 terrestrial radio stations. Radio's been very strong for our show and is strong for our company. But podcasting is a growing industry as well. And so I think Savage was probably smart to be able to, you know, divert a little bit of his show into a podcast, as you are.
So now the question that comes up after that, obviously in your company there is Rush, and that his health situation is deteriorating fast. I mean, that's going to leave a major hole in the middle of the lineup. I'm going to ask this question. Obviously, I know the answer, but I'm going to ask you this anyways. Would you take that time slot?
No, I'm a nighttime guy, Jim. It's my program, and right now it's Rush's, as long as he can handle it and take it.
I knew the answer was no. But I often joke that's more my time slot. Like, I like doing the little more variety a bit of stuff, but I'm not nearly as protocol as Rush's, so I don't think Premiere would even entertain that thought. But it's just a fun joke that I like to say. Because I don't know if I could do your slot. But I'm on the East Coast, too, so I think that factors. I know you're in the Midwest right now, but you also do the show from L.A., so that probably helps a great deal. And doing it
yeah,
for
no,
all these years.
A little break in terms of the time. But, you know, right now, L.A., with COVID and everything, is virtually on a lockdown. They don't even allow live music in a little place afterwards. It's crazy. Things are out of control. So I'm back in the Midwest where things have somewhat of a lifestyle, and I'm, you know, enjoying my stay.
So about that, though, I mean, I know you used to do live events. Do you miss going to places and meeting people?
Yeah, we've had lots of live events canceled, Jim. I love the one-on-one with folks. I love being on stage. I love the interaction with a live audience. I miss that. I miss that a lot. I was supposed to be in Chicago this coming weekend at a Health Freedom Expo. We're going to do it by Zoom. My portion, first time I've ever done Zoom before. They've got like 600-700 people who signed up for it, and it's growing every day, but you lose the excitement of being there live. It's just not the same.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking, doing my show, that's virtually the same thing. You know, there's people out there listening, but I mean, I guess you might get to see some of their faces, but it's still not the same as being there and then getting to, this is probably a bad phrase, work the room afterwards, but that's what it is.
Yeah, Zoom is almost like radio, where you know, do your thing and get a little response from people afterwards, but you definitely lose that personal feeling, that personal touch with folks.
So we've mentioned the COVID thing. How has that changed Coast at all, like the day-to-day operations of Coast, or has that remained the same throughout this process?
Well, a lot of people are working from home or wherever they were working before. But it's been an effect on every business, every person, and it's going to have an effect on people after the fact. If and when things get back to what we used to call normal, I think people are used to working out of their homes, working out of wherever they were working before, and companies are going to take a look at their lease arrangements with the buildings they're in and go,
well, gosh, we don't need this kind of space. We can get 50% of our employees to do exactly what they were doing and working out of their own house. Let's cut this. It's going to have an impact on everybody.
Yeah, I was talking to my wife about that the other day. I said, "We're, you know, everybody's worried about all these businesses closing." And I said, "Yeah, that's a problem. But the other problem is going to be the office space is going to just be vacant too, because, like you were saying, if everybody can work from home or a majority and have a smaller actual physical, I mean, there's tons of space that's going to be available in a variety of markets. Let alone, I know here in Pennsylvania they did a eviction freeze, so you couldn't evict anybody. And eventually, that's going to come due, and that's going to be just a sloppy mess when all these evictions come up.
Absolutely. I would not like to be in commercial real estate right now, Jimmy. Not in the least.
So, what's the next few years hold for George Norrie? I always tell people when they ask me about, you said on this program that they'd be basically pulling the mic out of your cool dead hands. Is that still where we're at with your future? No plans of slowing down?
No, absolutely. I mean, we're into our 18th year, and I'm just going to keep going, God willing, as long as I can. The network and I are talking about extending the contract well into the 2020s, deep into the 2020s, a decade. And I'm just going to keep going. You know, if the voice can stay young, you could be 120. Who cares, right? It's radio.
Yeah, I mean, as long as the mind's sharp and the voice is there, I mean, you can do it.
Exactly. Who am I talking to? Who are you?
Well, that's okay. People ask me that all the time. It's okay. It's nothing new. And more importantly, people ask, why am I talking to you? But that's a whole other can of worms. Okay. Now, I've seen this one come up, you know, but this is nothing new for you and me. We've talked about this before. The coast isn't the same it used to be even a couple years ago. There's a tension behind this, right? You guys aren't just throwing mud at the wall. You guys do have a vision for where it is today and where it needs to be going forward. You're just not slapping guests back to back to back.
I did one thing when I came in, Jim, and I changed the format and went to two guests a night instead of one. The reason for that is research was showing that if you got turned off by the first guest, you were gone. At least now we've got a better opportunity, the chance to keep that listener tuned in with two different people, two different types of stories, whether it's a harder news story and a paranormal one or something like that. And it's working for us. You know, when I took over, we were at 433 affiliates. And we are now up to 680. That's absolutely unheard of for commercial radio these days. So something's working. Something has also changed. This planet is different. It's changed. People, just by COVID, look what's happened to people. And you can't do paranormal 24/7 anymore. Those days are gone. It's unfortunate. They were fun. We always have it. It's the staple of the show. You will notice that the second half of every night is somewhat unusual and strange, but you can't do it 24/7. The times have changed.
I think also the influx of shows like mine has changed that too, because there's so much more paranormal content. Well, there's so much more content, paranormal content out in the universe, that back when Art was doing it in the early days, there was his that show doing it, and greater
back in those days. Yeah. You know, it was unique. It's different now. There's programs, as you just said, all over the place, dealing with different facets. You know, we've got some people who concentrate on ghosts. We have some people who concentrate on, Bigfoot and Sasquatch. And others just do UFO shows. You know, there's a variety out there. And, you know, we need to keep things mixed up. And what we have is a very loyal, growing, strong audience. The program's offered for free to radio stations. So we are advertiser-driven. And that continues to grow, too, even in an economic climate that is so-so for a lot of industry.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's impressive to watch the growth year after year. And every time I get the opportunity to talk to you to hear what is going on and how it's evolving, which, I mean, I was telling one of my listeners the other day about the local morning show here, and they do it as an internet broadcast and as a, it goes out to the AM stations, and they don't sync up. Like, it's awful to listen to. I'm sure it's great when you watch it on the internet, but it's like, well, just sync the commercials up and do a good product, but it doesn't, I don't know. That's a little rant. You don't have to comment on that, because I don't want to get you in trouble with people, but just do a little more work. Anyways, so I guess I should promo this while I've got you here, and I'll ask you. Next week, I do my annual prediction show for 2021. So, you know, I know you probably do yours late in December. I get it out of the way early. What do you think of 2021 holds?
I think COVID's going to carry over into 2021. Things are going to be much the same. You know, we're going to have an interesting presidential election in a week. That's going to, I think, affect how things happen in 2021 as well. I do think China has its eyes on Taiwan. God knows what's going to happen there and what we're going to do, because we do have a treaty to defend that country. So we'll have to see what happens. It's going to be an intriguing year. We do our prediction programs on December 31st and January 1st. So we do two of them back-to-back with different guests, astrologers, psychics, and people like that. But 2021 is going to be, unfortunately, a little bit of the same as 2020 going into it. And we'll see what happens toward the middle part to the end of the year, and hope things get better for people. All I know is this year, Jimmy, on New Year's Eve, when people are together holding hands, dancing, or doing whatever they do, and they always say, God, I'm glad this year is gone, they all mean it this time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like, you know, but I'm fully aware that we flip the calendar does not mean that the world actually changes, but it's going to feel good to at least get this 2020 off the book, so
yeah,
to speak.
Let's get it behind us and move forward and get people united again and get people happy. That's the important thing. You know, you've got a great audience. We've got a great audience. You know, people are people. And, you know, they just want to, one, have a happy life, enjoy their families, and, you know, and move on with it. I used to get bothered a lot in the early days of Coast to Coast, when I'd get any kind of criticism, and I had to grow into that. And you realize, you know, these are just people with their own little views. Some are haters. You know what I'm talking about.
There are plenty of them.
But you know what? Life moves on, so let's just do it. I'd still buy them a beer if I was in a bar with them.
Yeah, and I think most of them would probably come up to you, or you'd, you know, however that would go, and they'd have an adult conversation and be legitimate and probably on the happier side of things. I don't think too many people, I mean, it's easy to say things on the internet, I guess is where I'm headed.
I have never, ever had a person come up to me in person and be rude. Now, they may have been haters on the internet, but in terms of in person, they've always been friendly, delightful, and very courteous.
We need to get these live events back so I can change that. No.
You have been a supporter of mine for years. What are you saying?
Well, I just so we could film that moment of me walking up to you and saying something horrible and put it on the internet.
Do anything for publicity, you rat.
Well, that's the name of the game, right?
Sometimes.
No, I don't think so. I don't think there's good publicity and bad publicity, and then there's publicity you just don't want.
That's exactly right. Talk about publicity. That idiot on CNN, which I'm not even going to talk about, that's the kind of publicity you don't want.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not the... No, that's insanity to me. But, anyways. Oh, so I've got a listener question here for you, and it comes from Cat Word of Paranormal Heart. She does one of these great paranormal podcasts that we were talking about. I had to give her some credit for this. Prior to receiving the book given to him by your mother... At the age of 13, We Are Not Alone by Walter Sullivan, did young George have any paranormal experiences for himself?
No, the only thing that I had, if you want to call it paranormal, was that 11-year-old time where I had an out-of-body projection. And that is what it was, a catalyst for me to really get into this. I woke up in the morning, I was bouncing on the ceiling, looking down at my body,
which immediately then rammed myself into my physical body. I woke up and went, what is that? I thought it was a dream. Went to the library, found a book on astral projection, stumbled into that section, and sure enough, there was a picture of an astral body floating above the physical body in bed. And I said, that's exactly what happened to me. And I was obsessed with it ever since.
That's just remarkable to think about that, A, you were that present and then able to find said stuff to help you.
Absolutely. And the name of the book was Projection of the Astral Body by Hayward Carrington and Sylvan Muldoon. A great book.
Oh, George, actually, Whitley's calling in right now. Do you want to say hello to him yourself, or should I just push you off?
Yeah, whatever you want to do. Just introduce, you know, just tell him I'm on the line so he's not shocked.
Yeah, I will. Whitley, welcome to the Maurer Report. How are you doing this evening?
Hi, it's Whitley Strieber.
How are you doing? I've got George Norrie on the line, actually, just finishing up a little bit. Do you want to, just so you know, I actually got one more question for him, and then I'll be off to you, okay?
Okay, shall I call back or just hold?
Just hold for just a few seconds. George.
Okay, sure.
George, as we're going through this, Whitley's here, and I'm talking to him about his new book, and I know you talked to him about that a couple days ago. Experiencers. How are we defining them now? Are they still... Because I know there's a lot of hoaxes out there. I guess I'm not wanting to put him in that category. But it's harder because everybody has a story. Do you follow what I'm saying? Is it hard for you guys to sort out the mud on Coast?
Well, no, not at all. You know, Whitley has been probably one of the best guests we've had in this genre and just about any kind of topic, and he's the real deal.
Now, I'm just talking in general. I didn't mean to refer to him. I'm just saying...
No, I know that, but I'm using that as an example.
Okay.
We vet people by interviewing them extensively, and, you know, it's our job to try to find the best we can for our audience. Is it really happening to them? We don't know. And we'll never know. But I believe people like Travis Walton and Whitley Strieber and people like that, that these events have happened to. The Socorro, New Mexico event a long time ago with the police officer, Lonnie Zamora, something happened to him. So those are the kinds of guests we go after, and you know, and hopefully the audience appreciates that.
Well, George, I appreciate you immensely. And thanks for taking the time, and... We'll keep talking.
Continue success, Jim. You're one of the good guys.
Thank you, sir. Have a good afternoon. Before you go, who's on your show tonight?
Well, tonight we're going to have Lynn McTaggart on for the last 2 hours talking about intention experiments and her thoughts on COVID. In the first 2 hours, my colleague Ian Punnett has written a book about millennials, and he's on. So we're going to be doing it in a few hours.
Well, thank you, sir, and have a good show tonight.
Okay, and best to Whitley.
Whitley, thank you for joining me tonight, and thank you for allowing me to do that last little bit there.
Sure.
when he said he had time available, I just said, sure, and then I looked at my calendar and went, oh, no, I was already booked a little bit. So thank you for delaying, and thank you for being gracious there. You're here tonight to talk about A New World, your latest book.
Yes.
Give me the... I have it in my hands, and I've only partway through, so don't spoil the end for me, okay? But go ahead and give the listeners out there who have not heard or seen anything about this a little bit about it.
All right, well, in a long time ago now, back in 1985, I had a very bizarre experience in the middle of the night on December the 26th. And I basically woke up in a room full of very strange-looking creatures who had me, I was not mobile, I was trapped in some way that I didn't understand, and of course I thought it was a nightmare, and I kept trying to wake up, and finally I had to face the fact that I was awake, and I became upset, and then suddenly this voice turned on, that said in a very mild sort of female voice, what can we do, kept repeating, what can we do to help you stop screaming? And the answer was, not a lot. Unbelievably scary. I mean, it was just, and I was raped, and not intentionally. They were doing their thing, and I was fighting like a demon to get out of there. And they injured me in the fracas that resulted. And then I had, they put me, returned me to my bed, apparently. I don't remember that part of it. And I woke up the next morning, obviously very strung out and unsure about what had happened. I thought that there had been some kind of a, disturbance in the house. I thought there'd been an owl. I decided that there must have been an owl in the house because these things have these big eyes, and my mind was just not really willing to let me accept my memories. And so I said that to my wife, and she was sort of perplexed because, you know, it's the middle of the winter. We're out in the country. All the doors and windows are closed up tight. There's no chimney. I mean, there was a chimney, but it was for a wood stove, so nothing could have come down that chimney and lived because the stove was burning. So I was just at a loss. I couldn't figure it out and why I would have these memories. And finally, I became aware of the fact over the next couple of days that I was really sore. I hurt. I was beat up. I had a red mark on the side of my head, and my down below was injured. And so I went to the doctor, and he was pretty frank about it. He said, after examining me, he said, "You know, you understand you've been raped." I said, "I don't know how that could be," because I still didn't remember any of the things that happened. He said, "Well, something did this to you. You've had a violent encounter of some sort." And I just was left his office in a state of complete freakout. I didn't know what to think. And I began to try to... I thought it was a criminal act. It didn't occur to me anything about aliens. I never thought of such a thing. I might have been interested in flying saucers when I was a kid in the 50s, but we all were. I mean, I certainly hadn't thought of that in a long time. So couldn't figure out what motive would there be. I was a writer. I'd written a controversial book called War Day that had been Senator Kennedy had read parts of it out on the floor of the Senate, and he was so impressed by it. And I thought to myself, maybe some people who don't like Kennedy, you know, I just couldn't, but that just didn't seem real to me. Who would do it? Who would care that much? Who would find some writer out in the woods? I mean, it just didn't strike me as possible. Also, we had an alarm system. So, as it happened, my brother, who has a little bit more, he was more interested in this kind of stuff than I was, sent me a book for Christmas about UFOs. And, you know, I looked at it and just, oh, God, another one of these moronic gifts. And, you know, thank you very much. It's so interesting. I'm glad I have it. I plan to never read it. But then I thought to myself, wait a minute. That was a little room full of weird things. Could they have been aliens? Is that what that's about? So I read the book. And that's where it all started. The book had a mention of a UFO investigator called Bud Hopkins in it, who specialized in abductions. And I finally decided in March, I guess, as it happened in December, that had happened to me. That had happened to me. Now, 30 years later, I'm still involved with the visitors. I started going out in the woods at night, as scary as that was, because I just couldn't let it go. I mean, my God, people from another world? I'm not going to just sit there and mope about it. I wanted to figure out how can I somehow continue this relationship, because this is absolutely incredible. And, you know, I was scared to death. I won't lie to you. It was almost the first night I went out there, it was almost impossible to put one foot in front of another. It was like, I think it must have been like what would have been the ascend of gallows or something. But I did it anyway, and I kept doing it. And after a few months, they started to return. And the cabin became we had many people that came there and had experiences with them. It was absolutely amazing. I mean, they turned out to be really, really interesting creatures, whatever they are. I still don't know if they're aliens or not. I have no idea where they're from or exactly. But my wife passed away. Well, let me back up. Sometime in the mid-90s, we would get thousands of letters about this. This is before email. And she came out of her office one afternoon, and she said, Whitley, this has something to do with what we call death. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, look at what happens at the cabin. And look at what all these letters are saying. And what she was referring to is that whenever the visitors, as I call them, were around, people's dead friends and relatives would also sort of be involved, like Laurie Barnes, one of the witnesses at the cabin, was taking a walk one afternoon, and there standing in the road is her brother, who's been missing for 20 years and declared dead by the FBI. And she says, my God, what are you doing here? And he says, I just wanted to let you know I'm all right. And she says, but come down to the house and meet my friends. And he smiled at her and just sort of drifted off into the woods beside the road and was gone. She came back to the house shaking like a leaf. And Annie and I knew then the visitors would show up that night. We said that to no one, but they did. They showed up, and another lady named Raven Dana and a third lady all had an encounter. Oh, and two filmmakers, husband and wife, who were in the house also had an encounter with the same entity that night. And that's how it went. And now, fast forward to 2015, my wife passes away. And we are
You still there? Whitley, are you there? Well, that's a weird cut. It says he's still connected. That is an interesting one. That is weird. It says he's still connected. Guess I should... Yeah, let's do that. Yeah, so I just hung up on him because I want him to ring me back here. Maybe I can see. Yeah, it was weird. That is still weird because it was still connected and the call just, like, dropped off the face of the earth. And, I'm trying to figure out how, because I had the calls joined together there, how to get them back apart. Ooh, Skype. That's always fun. Okay. By the time I get this all figured out, typed in, he'll probably call me back. Good radio here as I type. Okay, I think I got that.
Hello?
Welcome back. You were just saying that your wife had passed and the call just dropped off the face of the planet.
I thought you hung up on me.
No, I did it. I would not do that to you.
you can expect that with me. You try. I have a podcast. Try running a podcast with all this craziness in your life. But let's keep on. Anyway, she passes on, and later that night, the friend calls, and I'm proceeds to say, the strangest thing just happened. I just heard Anne's voice in my ear telling me to call you, and I thought, that's odd. I said, well, honey, Anne passed away earlier this evening at 7:15. And this kept happening with other friends. I mean, people, you know, by the next day, they all knew she had died, but they didn't. This lady had not known that night, I don't think. But it kept happening. And then I realized and remembered that back when we had realized that this supposed alien abduction thing was also very connected with the appearance of the dead and so forth, we made a pact, Ann and I did, that we would tell nobody, but that the one who died first would try to connect with the other one, not directly, but by connecting through friends. And Ann did it. And it was extraordinary. And she, you know, we're like still married. I mean, we wrote a book together after she died called The Afterlife Revolution. And it was turned out to be an amazing, beautiful thing to be connected with the visitors, because it's made my life much bigger, and it's made my grief and my experience of my wife's passing a much different thing than it normally is. You know, they're a hard bunch. I mean, they're not easy to deal with, but they have got immense understanding of the nature of the world. And if you get involved with them, you begin to learn from them. And that's what the book A New World is all about. What I have learned since 2015, when they came roaring back into my life after Annie passed away. And so did Annie in another way. It's a marvelous life, I have to tell you. I never would have thought it would have been like this, but it is.
And for everybody out there who doesn't know, it's available today. Actually, it released today. Is that correct?
A New World is available. Yeah, absolutely. You can get in hardcover, softcover, and other methods, I think, too. Audible, Kindle, all of it.
So I've got to ask this question. And I have, back 30 years ago, after this first incident happened and you started going to the woods, I'm sure, because this is how this goes in my house, you had a discussion with your wife. How did that first discussion go, saying that you were going to go back and try to have this communication?
She was always for it. She never thought of them as being something evil at all. It was absolutely... Anne is the one who directed the whole experience. When I was writing the book Communion, Anne was the one who edited, who formed it, who made it what it became. And I was going to call it body terror, because it was like the ultimate terror that I had experienced. And she said, no, 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 that's not what it's about, Whitley. This is about contact with them. It's about more than contact. It's about communion. And that's why we called it communion, because it's about this deep sharing of souls. And that is what it's about, by the way. And it's how I live. I share myself with this presence. I don't call them the visitors anymore. I just think of it as a presence. And she wasn't concerned. When I said I was going to go out in the woods, her main concern was that I had the guts to actually do it. And she would say, so are you going to start tonight? And I would say, well, listen, it's not you going out there. She said, Whitley, go out and see what happens. See what happens. I said, what if you never see me again? What if I go out there and just disappear? She said, nope, that's not going to happen. She knew. My wife was a magical person, and she was a brilliant, just an extraordinary woman, and totally capable of doing this. It was like she was trained for it.
Was she into this type of, even the like ghosts or anything before this experience to you?
Or is not at all. Neither one of us were. Not at all. I mean, I'd written some horror novels, and so, yeah, we knew about vampires and ghosts, but...
Yeah, well, there's a difference between writing about them and living with them, I guess is the easy way to put it.
Yeah, there's a great deal of difference between writing fiction about vampires and werewolves and things and waking up in the middle of the night and you're in a room full of goblins. It's real. That's a big leap there.
Actually, it was one of the questions I wanted to ask you about the difference it takes from going from nonfiction to fiction, and the amount of work and how that all comes together for you. Because I noticed I've talked to some writers who just do one or the other, and only a few bounce back and forth. So give me some insight into that, because I know you do it and do it well.
Oh, thank you. I do both, and I enjoy both. I've just finished a book, which is A New Vision of Jesus, which is total. It's nonfiction from beginning to end. And I like to write fiction. It exercises my imagination, and I enjoy it. And I'm probably going to write another book of fiction soon. But the process is very different. Fiction versus nonfiction, they're very different. Nonfiction is intellectually rigorous. Fiction is introspectively rigorous. You have to look inside yourself for the characters. You have to find them. And you have to surrender to them and let them become alive and take over your life when you're writing them. You have to belong to them. You are their instrument and their tool to express their experiences out in the world. They have to feel very real to you. And, you know, a writer who does it that way, whose characters feel real to him or to her, and one who doesn't, you can tell it instantly in the first two sentences of any book they write. You can't construct, you have to construct nonfiction. Fiction you can't construct. It creates itself, or it never comes to life.
Yeah, I do tend to stay with the nonfiction stuff, but the fiction stuff always draws me. And I guess I'm not that creative and able to get that far down the path. So I do appreciate immensely when you're able to just let it go and get it done. So
yeah.
So
I've got characters banging around in my head right now who want a book. So I might write another book of fiction very soon.
I was going to say, so you obviously just got this book that came out today. You said you've got the next one done. Is that what I just heard?
Yeah, I've finished the manuscript. It's not going to be published.
So you're probably starting on, how many book ideas do you have, like in an index card system or wherever you just throw ideas at?
It's all in my head.
Oh, so how much
my index card system is in my head? In my head right now, I have a film script that a friend, a producer, wants me to write very badly, and that I'm probably going to write. I have a novel, two novels, and a possible another nonfiction book that is forming somehow. I'm not quite sure what it's about yet. That's what's rolling around in there right now.
That's just crazy to think about all that stuff going on in there, plus the day-to-day life, how things have to be.
Yeah, well, it's the truth. I love doing it. I was made to do this. This is my vocation.
That's where I was going to ask next. Do you sit down and write for a fixed amount of time, or you just go after it whenever the mood hits you?
My writing doesn't belong to me. I belong to my writing. And my writing, if my writing wants me, I'm perfectly capable of doing a 24-hour shift. I work endlessly. Endless. I never stop. I love it. I love the struggle and the worst thing in the world is a blank page. And also the best, because you can fill it with anything, and you might just fill it with something wonderful, and you never can be sure. So I work all the time. I love to work.
Well, obviously.
I also, I have my podcast. I have my website.
Yeah, well, as I say, give me some of that stuff, because we've got to get it out there. The people who
the podcast is called Dreamland, and you can get it on Apple Podcasts, on all kinds of places. It's on Alexa. It's on TuneIn Radio. It's just all over the place, basically. And you can also get it on my website, unknowncountry.com. And it comes in two versions, a free version, which is an hour long and has commercials, and a subscriber version, which is an hour and a half long and has no commercials. The website's got a huge archive of stories and all kinds of interviews and everything dating back to 2004. And it's got a big social media component with weekly chats with me on Wednesday evenings and video meetings and a free message board and all kinds of stuff. It's a very, very active site.
Well, it keeps you active for sure. I mean,
did I say its name? It's called unknowncountry.com.
I think you did, but as the joke goes, it's better to say it twice than not say it at all.
Right.
So I want to go back through this. They've been with you for 30 years now, and it recently picked up again. Was there ever a time that you thought it was over?
Yeah, many times. You know, they come and go on their own schedule. I can't predict it. I will say this, though. I have found one thing that when I'm at conferences and if there's somebody staying in the room with me, the visitors are almost always going to show up because they're not flying around in flying saucers. They come out of the air. I mean, their methods of whatever they have a completely different relationship to reality than we do. And even a few seconds with them to somebody who hasn't been with them a lot is extremely hard. My co-author for my book before last, Supernatural, Jeff Kripal, who is he's a professor of religious studies at Rice University and a good friend, was with me at Esalen a couple of years ago, which is this beautiful sort of retreat on in Big Sur in Northern California, overlooking the Pacific. And he wanted to stay in the room with me, and I said, Jeff, they're gonna be here because this room is so perfect. It was an isolated place, and the room had a little deck, and then there was a cliff overlooking the Pacific Ocean, an ideal place for them. And they always like isolated places, although they come to this apartment all the time. They're used to that. But if you'd like, I go to a city, a big hotel in a city. If I don't stay for 3 or 4 days, I'm not going to see them. But at Esalen, no question, I would see them. And so they show up in the room. And this is only one of them. It's a very brief meeting, because there's something about the way they are that's different from the way we are. It's real hard for us. They are outside of time looking in is the best way to describe it, I believe. We are inside time, and when the river of time, if you get near them, you're pulled out of the river of time. It's like being the confusion, the total confusion of a fish being suddenly pulled out of the water. Something that seemingly couldn't happen. So one of them comes in and they wants to meditate with me, meaning it would wake me up by touching me usually on the hand or blowing in my face or something. And then I'll go sit and I'll meditate. And usually I don't see him. Sometimes I see him when I'm meditating, not often. But it also woke Jeff up. And he said he heard this crashing sound, like the whole world was crashing down around him. And then he said, I heard my own voice somewhere inside me cry out, oh my God. And it's because there's a total implosion of your reality when they get near you, unless they are very, very cloaked, very, very suppressed, I would say. But they don't need to be that way around me because I'm used to it. So he was deeply shaken, and that happens. Annie only saw them once or twice, and she wasn't comfortable with being with them physically. Although she knew so much more about them than I did, she still couldn't handle it. Interestingly enough, our cats were unbelievably terrified by them. They were almost rendered unconscious with fear when the visitors came into the cabin, when they were there. I was afraid they'd have heart attacks.
Well, I could see why. I mean, that's not an everyday occurrence for us, let alone them. And then,
you know, when a cat gets scared, his tail puffs up.
Yep.
It turns out that there's another level of fear in a cat. The entire cat can puff up. You've never seen anything like it. They look like giant caterpillars.
I was just picturing that in my head. That's just...
It's funny. It was funny. And they like crawl along the back of the couch going, row, row. And you think to yourself, well, if the cats are so scared, am I some kind of fool?
Yeah, well, I think we've established that, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you have to be a fool to go out there and do this. Because in the end, I used to say to Annie, what if in the end I am just eaten? And she said, well, you had a good ride. This is true.
Man.
But, you know, they never hurt anybody in my family, in the cabin, children, adults. They came around all the time when our son had friends there. And we told all the parents, we said, listen, this is real. This is happening, and not one parent ever wanted their child not to come there, not even when the children would come home and say what, tell things of stories of what happened to them. And some of it is eerie and creepy. I wouldn't say some of it's ominous. There's some elements of danger in here that are not understood and that are pretty scary.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm thinking about your cats, and then you mentioned children. I'm thinking, as a, 36-year-old man, I'm not sure I'm ready for any of this.
No, nobody's ever ready for it. That's one of the problems they have. You know, they're not going to sit down, and, you know, a lot of the military people do not like them at all. They don't like me either, because I'm able to handle this, and I guess they resent it a little bit and fear it. And there's been trouble. There's plenty of trouble. A researcher called Frank Ficino, some years ago, wrote a very good book about the sort of underside of this called Shoot 'Em Down. And, it was basically about all the violent exchanges between them and the military that have taken place through the 50s and 60s. And, you know, it turned out that one of my uncles was involved in the Roswell incident, and he introduced me to his commanding officer, General F. Exon, Arthur Exon, who was later, he was retired when I met him, but he had been commanding at Wright Patt Air Force Base. And when it was Wright Field, and they were both young officers, the debris from Roswell was brought there because they were in the Air Materiel Command, which analyzed, basically foreign aircraft and weapons and things like that. So it fell to them. They were among the officers who tried to analyze this material. And, after our published communion, my uncle called me, and I was living in New York, and he was down in San Antonio, Texas, and he said, Whitley, you need to come down. I want to talk to you about your book. And all we knew about his career was that it had been top secret his whole career. We never knew a thing about what he did. And he proceeds to tell me the story of the Roswell incident, which I had actually not heard of until I... Now, I think I had heard of it. I take that back. Anyway, to my amazement, he starts talking about the materials and analyzing them. And I said, are you telling me that you were there? He said, no, I was at Wright with Art Exon. Art's going to want you to call him, and here's his number. And so I wrote a whole book based on what they told me Majestic. Speaking of fiction, they had no documentation, but they were, you know, two mature, sincere men, a colonel and a general in the United States Air Force, and I don't think that they were lying. And so I wrote this novel called Majestic, which sort of explores the whole thing that happened at Roswell. It was fascinating. But the visitors they're not easy. And the book A New World is based on something that an intelligence officer who wrote his own book about this subject said that he had had, and his book is, I'm not sure it's all true, or, you know, the memories in it are kind of screwy. I mean, he himself was very plain spoken about it. He said it was just all so strange. I did my best. At one point, he was in a situation where he was able to ask them, one of them, a question. And he asked, what is in it for us? And the answer was, a new world, if you can take it. And that means they're going to always compress everything. If you can take it means if you can bear it, you can handle it, if you can get it out of our hands, if you can hold on to it. And the book is basically, my book, A New World, is about those very things. It's about the experience of living intimately with them in a way that was productive and useful to me. As to far as whether it was useful to them, I don't know, but they came back and they still do. So it must have some value to them as well. And it's hopefully the beginning of some kind of real contact, because we could use some help here. I mean, yeah, we really could. And, you know, they're there. They're here, whoever they are.
So I've got this half quacked up question, bad pun because I'm Jim Mallard, because anyways, what prompted you to write the book now? Because this experience has been going on for a while now.
Oh no, they've got a timeline, man. And this was on their timeline. I did not plan. I got this. They started the book, and they don't have like holidays and evenings, apparently. I wrote that book very fast because they wanted it out. They wanted it out. Now, what we're talking about here today is not the original book. The original book was out last summer, or last November. This is the broader publication of it through Beyond Word, through a conventional publishing house. In order to get it out on their timeline, I had to put the initial edition, the Kindle edition, out myself. And they are on some kind of a timeline, it seems to me. And I think that we're in a lot of trouble here, and I think that they want us to survive. I think they started declaring their presence here in 1947 because we started using atomic weapons. And ever since then, they have been extremely interested in our atomic facilities of all kinds, and then ultimately also interested in us. And I have wondered if the abductions, which took place starting in large numbers, starting in the 60s and going through the 80s and into the early 90s, were not an attempt to make a record of us, a DNA record, and using sexual materials, in case we fail completely as a species. I don't know. Because one thing they're not going to do is they're not going to get in the way of our fate. It's your world. You have to live it, basically. And they're very aware of, at least they have been in my life, of cultural colonization. That is to say, when someone of much greater technological prowess comes into the lives of someone with less, the person, the individuals with less, totally focus on the ones with more, and they lose all of their own individuality and integrity. And you see that all over the world, wherever the European empires went with their beautiful silverware and cutlery and knives and guns and all that stuff, the local people just forgot about their own world and became totally dependent, and they don't want that to happen. So at the same time, they don't want us to go under. So they're kind of walking a tightrope. They're going to do as much as they can to help us.
Well, I hope so. I mean, because we're doing all we can to screw each other up. So I hope somebody out there is going to.
I know it, but they are not going to. They are not. If we decide to go, if we do not help ourselves, they will not help us. But the more we help ourselves, the more they will help us. But we have to do it. And right now we're doing everything we can to pretend this planet isn't falling apart around our ears, but it is.
It's crazy.
All the fires, the storms, and you know, we don't even read about the massive fires that were in Siberia this summer because it's so far away. We just read about the ones on the coast of California, but in fact, are in the Amazon burning down. And I wrote a book years ago called Nature's End before I ever met the visitors, and it's eerily predictive of what is happening now. It's very strange. You know, you wonder, and of course in 1985 when I tried to do press for the book, the environmental reporters just laughed in my face and said it would never be this bad, and you know, that there wouldn't be any fires in the Amazon in 2020 or anything like that. And unfortunately the book was accurate. It's a work of fiction. I wrote it with a friend, Jim Konecka, and he is a science writer, and you know, sort of was fiction and fact mixed together.
It's scary where we're at today. I mean, compared to where we were and where we could be headed, it just blows my mind at times.
Well, it's going to get very intense very quickly. The next few years are going to be each one. There will be a time when we look back to 2020 with nostalgia and think to ourselves, oh, things were so much easier then.
I don't want to think about that. Hey, we're almost...
No, me neither.
We've got about 2 minutes left. I just looked at the clock, and you know how that goes when you're doing these kind of shows. So people can get a New World by Whitley Strieber anywhere fine books are sold, even Audible and all these other great things.
Fine books, that'll probably work too.
Well, you have a bunch of them out there too.
Well, I don't have too much in print right now. A New World is in print, and Afterlife Revolution is in print, and Supernatural is in print, and a book called The Key. I think those are the ones that are actually available in the stores. You know, and you can order. But they're there. They're definitely there. And it was a marvelous experience to write. Working directly with them. That's fabulous. I'm a lucky man, I have to tell you.
You sure are. Hey, I appreciate the time that we got to track you down again, and there's a whole bunch of other things that I just obviously didn't even get into because we're just so many things with you because you have been a lucky man.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And thank you for coming. Have a good evening.
Yep.
And that's the legendary Whitley Strieber. And the legend George Norrie, and I'm just absolutely blown away to pull that stunt off and have them together. And the annual prediction show next week. Man, what a great ride we've been on. From Rand Goldman last week talking about COVID and children's virtual reality to George and Whitley to predictions. This is just the great time of year for me. great time for the show. So I just want to say I appreciate you all for being here. I've seen some great faces in here tonight. And, man, be ready for next week. That's all I can say.
Science! 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 Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes...
Yes!
Woo!
Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.